Normally I start with a few minutes clarification, some corrections. I'm going to actually save that to the end. Someone asked me about the Gedolim, who had non-religious people in their families. I have some interesting stuff for those who like that. And I think it's also important, Mussar, for all of us. But I'll save that to the end, because I want to finish up really with Ritzvi Yehuda. We ended last class by talking about how he supported Sheryl Lumi, and actually Ares pointed out correctly that this went against the chief rabbinate, and in the secret book, which I'll get to in a little while, they ask him about this. How come if Rav Hertzatz opposes Sheryl Lumi, you support? And he says, I follow the Rambam and the Radbaz, not Rav Hertzog. And that's where we really ended last class. But you can already see from what we've gotten to that this would create conflicts between him and members of the Haredi world, especially Rav Schacht's community certainly had no love lost for Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And yet the truth is that while in the Haredi world Rav Tzvi Yehuda was not treated with respect, he was called Tzvika, things like that, for the most part, in the religious Zionist world, the Haredi Gedolim, and this has always been the trend, were given a lot of respect. There was a time, it's recorded by Rav Aviner, when one of Rav Tzvi Yehuda's students strongly criticized Rav Schacht, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda rebuked him, saying that what's okay for me to say is not okay for you to say. And that really was Rav Tzvi Yehuda's line, that he, as we'll see, he criticized the Lubavitcher Rebbe, criticizes the Rav, we'll get to that in a few minutes, but it was very important for him that this is not something for the students to be involved in, it's only something for him to be involved in, because when students start doing it, it's no longer a dispute between different sages and scholars, it becomes personal and all sorts of problems. And he could speak sharply about Gedolim, that is Rav Tzvi Yehuda, when they didn't accept his religious national perspective. Obviously the Chazon Ish, who he dealt with, he was a very important figure, and he stood in complete opposition to everything that Rav Avram Cook and Rav Tzvi Yehuda stood for. So it was important for Tzvi Yehuda to downplay the significance of the Chazon Ish, make him, after all, the Chazon Ish's non-Zionism, his suspicious view of the state, prevented him from being embraced by the religious nationalists. So what did Tzvi Yehuda say? Again, this comes from the secret book, and it's probably passages, well, it's definitely passages like this. In fact, I was told it's this passage I'm going to read you right now, which is the reason why it had to be withdrawn from circulation immediately, so much so that it never even made it to the bookstores. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says as follows, and I quoted this in an article. The Chazon Ish was not the Gadol Hador. The Gadol Hador and the Halachic Decisor par excellence was my father, of blessed memory. Okay, that we can understand. But then he goes on. In Vilna, there were other laymen who were Gedolim. Remember, the Chazon Ish was a layperson. He never had an official position. And then he lists a number of names, including Rav Yochum Fishel Perla. If you know the name, he wrote the commentary on Rasad Yagod's, when Rasad Yagod's Sfarim. And then he says, even if the Chazon Ish was a Gadol, put an exclamation point after that, even if he was a Gadol, he was not the Gadol for this generation and for generations to come. So here he's really, in a sense, tearing down the Gadol of the Haredi world and saying basically he's just another posek, and that we're not guided by him, and that no one should be guided by him because that is very strong stuff. And as you can imagine, if Avram Shapiro thought it was too strong to go out into the world, but you see from this the problem that Rav Tzvi Yehuda has when you have someone who's regarded as the Gadol Hador by so many, who has a different perspective. He needs to be shown, for at least from Rav Tzvi Yehuda's position, that he's not the Gadol Hador, that he's simply another posek, and that we should not leave our path. People were telling the religious Zionists, the Mizrahi, that the Chazon Ish is the Gadol Hador, and he's against Mizrahi. It's time for you to adopt a different perspective. The Brisker Rav was a totally separate. The Brisker Rav really, he didn't have the same sort of influence the Chazon Ish had, publicly, that is. Privately, he, people would go to the Brisker Rav, but the Brisker Rav was hard to figure out because he would tell that he would support the anti-Zionists, he would support the Aguda. He sort of gave different answers, but as far as I know, Rav Tzvi Yehuda never said anything about the Brisker Rav, and the Brisker Rav did come out with statements, I think for two reasons. One, I think the primary reason is the Brisker Rav did not have the same influence. Now he has an enormous amount of influence, but in his lifetime, he was thought to be somewhat of an extremist, and he didn't have the same influence on the Haredi world as a whole. After all, the Brisker Rav was basically an Eidach Haredi Mitzray Karta person. People don't like to recall that today, but he was really anti-Zionist, and he didn't have the same sort of influence like the Chazon Ish had. there were people who attacked him. Rav Maimon. Rav Maimon attacked the Brisker Rav. And when you think about the Brisker Rav, he's such a tzaddik that even though he had these extremist positions, to attack him was thought to be going over the line. But Rav Maimon did, and that's why in the Haredi world, Maimon was basically put in cheirim. Tomorrow, I'm actually interviewing, together with Menachem Butler, Rav Gulevsky. I spoke about him a few times. In fact, last night I was at a party at one of the restaurants he gives hashkacha for, one of the Indian restaurants. He probably is the last surviving person from Brisk who can speak about Gedolei Brisk. That is, his grandfather was Rav Simcha Zelig. And Brisk, the entire community, was destroyed in the Holocaust. The only people who were alive were people who got out ahead of time, and I don't think he might be the last real Talmud Chacham left from Brisk who could speak about the Brisker Rav. So I'm going to interview him. He's well into his 90s about the Brisker Rav and about his grandfather, Simcha Zelig, and the Rav, who he's very close to. So basically, that's what I think you can say about the Brisker Rav. Ritzi Yehuda never thought that he was a significant person to criticize. And the Brisker Rav himself never wanted to be a significant personality. When Ben Gurion came to see him, he refused to speak to him. He didn't get involved publicly in a lot of these things. He signed a few public statements, but really, he wasn't that sort of a figure. You had to go to the Brisker Rav and develop a relationship. He wasn't like the Chazon Ish that was really for the whole world. The whole world looked to the Chazon Ish. And I have pictures. I don't have them here. I can't reach them here. I'm in my office today, not upstairs. I have pictures of the Brisker Rav together with Rav Harlap, together with Ritzi Pesach Frank, together with the sorts of people that the ideology of which he did not support. What were some other aspects of Ritzi Yehuda's ideology? Well, first of all, and this repeats what we said last time, he was not a visionary. His father was the visionary. His father was speaking in mystical, theoretical terms. Ritzi Yehuda was a man of action, bringing his father's teachings into the practical, the complicated world. And this is not an easy thing to do. We had three classes on Rav Kook. We saw some of the contradictions in his writings. It's no accident that people like Rav Amital, who, by the way, is a student of Ritzi Yehuda, that people like Rav Amital are on the left of religious Zionism. They see themselves as followers of Rav Kook. At the same time, you have, obviously, the right wing. There's different trends in the thought. Ritzi Yehuda took what he thought to be the most significant of the trends, the particularistic, and he focused on it. In fact, he said that the pinnacle of his father's thought is Orot. I'll speak about Orot in a few minutes, the book Orot, which is written in the land of Israel. Much of the more universalistic elements of Cook's teachings are written in Chutz La'aretz, the diaspora Torah, according to Ritzi Yehuda. But in Orot, you see the Segulat Yisrael, you see the specialness of Israel. The influence of the Ramban, of Rabbi Yehuda Levi. And it's a very, you'd say, I guess, ethnocentric, but not ethnocentric the way they use it today, but focusing on the fact that Israel is really the center of the world, but for benefit of the entire world. I'll quote to you later what Yehuda says about the rest of the world. It's in Orot that you have the Eretz Yisrael position, which focuses on building up the land. It focuses on the significance of the non-religious. There are many Haredi who quoted passages from Rav Kook about how he was very critical of the non-religious, very harsh things even. He has one essay which he wrote in the journal Hapeles when he was in a Rav in Lithuania, and they quoted this. And Ritzi Yehuda said that this is Chutz La'aretz Torah. That yes, it's one thing to speak about the non-religious in the diaspora, but when you're in the land of Israel, the non-religious are serving a different function, as we'll get to. And he says that everything Rav Kook writes is holy, obviously, but Orot is Kodesh Kadashim, holy of holies. He's obviously playing on the Song of Songs, you know, that all the writings are holy, but the Song of Songs is holy of holies. And that all of the religious Zionist ideology comes out of Orot. What then to do about people like Rav Amital and others who wanted to interpret Rav Kook differently? Rav Tzvi Yehuda said that I'm the Hemshech Absoluti. I am the complete Hemshech, the complete culmination, the following of my father. There can be no other approach. Michal Nehorai, today he's a professor at Bar Ilan University, was at that time one of the Ramim, one of the teachers at the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva. And he said, he thought that he could come up with a different perspective. He said that we have to interpret Rav Kook differently than Rav Tzvi Yehuda. There's different approaches to it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda refused to allow him to teach at Merkaz after that. He had to leave the yeshiva. It became a huge controversy. and he's now at Bar-Ilan. By the way, I'll tell you that Rav Yehuda was not opposed to secular study, since I mentioned Bar-Ilan, not at all. In fact, he had a very close relationship with a woman, actually, Rivka Schatz, who was a non-religious scholar, great scholar of Kabbalah. He would have a weekly gap with her, a weekly seminar with her on Kabbalah. And they would read his father's works together. And today, the people in America, they have no idea who Rivka Schatz was, but they know one thing, that Rav Yehuda gave her respect, and therefore they should give her respect. Rav Yehuda was asked, in all this religious Zionism we spoke about last week, and I'll speak about it in a few minutes again, he was asked, aren't you forcing the end? Aren't you being dochek et haketz? One of the things is Jews are not supposed to force the end. The Messianic era is supposed to come on its own. And he replied, we're not forcing the end. The end is forcing us. That is, we've already moved into that era where it's time for us to do our share. The Haredi vision of Judaism is timeless. There's no concern in the Haredi vision of Judaism for anything other than, Torah study and mitzvot. The whole outside world only has value in the utilitarian sense. That is, you join the government because it can help you get money for your yeshivas, you settle the land so you can build yeshivas, everything relates to that. There's one value, or one and a half values, because you have mitzvot also, but that relates to Torah study. For Rav Yehuda, following his father, this is Golas Judaism. In the Golas, this is how you live. It's now time for Jews to return to the real world. Being in the real world means living as real people. You can't live in a ghetto anymore. That's what Jews lived in Chutz Laaretz. Remember, it used to be that we lived in the world, and the world was a secular world, and we looked forward to a messianic era, which would be an era of spirituality, of holiness. But with Rav Yehuda, we are now in the messianic era. He says it. We're at the beginning, but we are part of the messianic era. It's not even Atchatadul of the beginning. We're actually in the antechamber, he says. The Messiah will not bring the messianic era. The messianic era is here. The messianic era will bring the Messiah. From the Haredi perspective, the Messiah comes, and then comes the messianic era. From Rav Yehuda's perspective, the messianic era comes, and that brings the Messiah. The Messiah is the culmination. It's the end of the messianic era. That is this great figure who's going to be a symbol for Jews. That comes at the end. Let's think back a few minutes to the dialectic of Rav Kook that we spoke about. Remember what the Golus is. The Golus is one aspect of Judaism. In the Golus, spirituality is divorced from physicality. How do we live in the Golus? In the Golus we lived as, we had farms, and we were engaged in business, all that, but everything we did was simply secular. If you're living in upstate New York and you have a farm, well, that's nice. You can make a living having a farm, but there's no connection to Torah or anything. You make a living, and then you can do the important things, the spiritual things. However, that's Golus Judaism. In the land of Israel, holiness is not just spirituality like it is in the diaspora. In Israel, holiness is much broader. Everything you do shares in holiness. So if you have a farm in the land of Israel, that's holy, because you're involving yourself in the land of Israel. That you're going back to the way Jews used to live. You might say it's the old form of Judaism, but it's the authentic form. In the days of King David, when in addition to studying Torah, you fought battles, you fought the wars. That's what King David is described in the Talmud as doing. In Israel, everything you do is regarded as holy. In America, if you want to be a policeman, okay, it's a nice profession. In Israel, you're involved in creating of a state where Jews can live, and there's Tikkun Olam and everything. That's holy. This is all holiness. So in the land of Israel, obviously you need to have spirituality, you need to study Torah. However, that's only one aspect. You also have to live as real people. And Rav Kook says that you serve God through working out, through exercising, through being a complete person. Rav Kook and Rav Yehuda after him, they believe that the yeshiva movement, which is obviously the basis of Haredi Judaism, where people simply study Torah all day, and that's the be-all and end-all of Judaism, that's a Golus manifestation. That's how Jews lived in the Golus when Judaism was only spirituality. However, in the land of Israel, since you live a complete life, Torah study is only one aspect, and your yeshiva needs to be different. So Merkaz Harav is supposed to be a yeshiva where you study not just different writings, hashkafah, philosophy, all the things that you didn't study in the traditional yeshivas, but it's supposed to provide the guidance for life in a modern state. Now, So we see the dialectic is that there will be a synthesis. You have of spirituality, you have the spirituality in the Golis. You have the physicality in the land of Israel, where you're building up the land, which is probably dominated by the non-religious, and there's going to be a synthesis. And you're going to have a new Eretz Yisrael Jew, which combines both physicality and spirituality, and which we spoke about with Rav Kook. The problem with the non-religious is that they only saw the Golis Judaism, which is a deformed Judaism, which is a false Judaism, which told people that any involvement in the outside world is not real Judaism. So they had to reject all that, but now that they're in the land of Israel, they can get true Judaism, which is a dialectic of the spiritual and the physical, and that's what Tzvi Yehuda's vision. But Tzvi Yehuda did think there should be full-time Kollel people. In fact, Merkatz HaRav is not a Hesder yeshiva. Tzvi Yehuda spoke out against Hesder. He said that he thought Hesder, like Rav Shach, Rav Shach and Tzvi Yehuda only agreed on one thing, and that's Hesder. They both thought that Hesder is not the ideal, and that it's for people who are not ready for full-time yeshiva. The difference is, Tzvi Yehuda said, is that in our yeshiva, Merkaz, when they're learning full-time, but when they're done learning, they go to the army. And when they are learning, they have a connection to the army and a connection to the land of Israel. It's not a draft dodge. They're not doing it because they want to be separate from society. And they're not doing it because they think it's dangerous. They're doing it because they think their learning is vital. But the army is something very positive. As we saw last week, the army is holy. So there really are two forms of soldiers for Tzvi Yehuda. There's the Torah student, and there's the one who's in the army. And for Tzvi Yehuda, obviously not everyone can be a Torah student. It's not a draft dodge, not at all. And basically, to conclude with that aspect, before we move on, for Tzvi Yehuda to continue to be living today as you live in the Golis, which is how the Haredim live, as a Shita, that's what the Chazon Ish's view, is a refusal to recognize the cosmic change that has occurred in Jewish life. It's mamish to be blind to God's providence. It's to be what Tzvi Yehuda said, I mentioned last week, to be one of those tzaddikim who don't believe. They see providence in front of them, and they don't believe. And then Tzvi Yehuda dwelled upon how the Golis is such a false existence. We spoke last week about the Holocaust. In fact, I probably tonight when I finish here, I'm going to do another op-ed for the Jewish Week about, because I spoke to the editor, they told me to send it in if I have time tonight, all about John Hagee. And I'm going to point out that all these people attacking John Hagee, Tzvi Yehuda, who as I'll mention in a few minutes, he loved every Jew. If any Gadol loved every Jew, no matter who the Gadol was, he could not hate a Jew. He couldn't hate Tommy Lapid. He couldn't hate anyone. It was Tzvi Yehuda. And Tzvi Yehuda said the same thing Hagee said. Like I said, I don't agree with the theodicy, but this idea that you can attack someone for being an anti-Semite, Tzvi Yehuda saw it that way, as we saw last week. The Holocaust has positive elements to it. Because how could you say that? Because everything has positive elements. This is a basic Kabbalistic teaching. There is holy sparks even in the worst. Even in the destruction of the temple, there's positive things that came out of it. Last class, we even quoted Rav Henkin, who's not a Makubo, who spoke about how the fact that we no longer can execute people, he was against capital punishment, that is one of the positive things that came out, because we no longer, and that's on the way to the Messianic era, because in the Messianic era, people are not going to have the Yetzer Hara for violence. So the fact that we can no longer execute people, that's something positive. We bless God for the bad, Gamzo Zuatov, that even the bad has good elements, and one of the positive things, the Holocaust is the most terrible thing. Tzvi Yehuda said Avarachamim every Shabbos. Didn't matter what Shabbos. You know, we only say it on certain Shabboses. Other Shabboses we don't say it because it's a sad prayer or calls the sadness of the Crusades. And Tzvi Yehuda said, and his own minion, they did this. After the Holocaust, he says, I will say Avarachamim every week because the suffering that Klal Yisrael went through during the Holocaust is enough that it overcomes any reason not to say Av HaRachamim. But even the Holocaust has something positive in it, as it destroyed the impurity of, as it destroyed the Golis, and Jews recognized that there was no longer a place from there, and the impurity of the Golis, the assimilation which was found so much in Europe, it was destroyed. Now, Tzvi Yehuda, I mean, he had to confront people who didn't recognize the significance of the Holocaust. First of all, in showing anti-Semitism, that there's no place for the Jews in the exile, and also showing the problem from the Jewish perspective, this attachment to the lands of the exile. Rav Tzvi Yehuda spoke about the impurity. He used all the Kabbalistic lingo about the impurity of the land. It's not just Kabbalistic, of course. It's in the Talmud also. It speaks about impurity of the land. You have certain Kohanim who are so pious they will never leave the land of Israel. In fact, you have many people, very holy people, who won't leave the land of Israel. Rav Charlap refused to go, and others, because of the impurity. But that's a halakha concept. The Mekubalim, the Kabbalists, elaborate on the not just the Kabbalistic idea, and not just the halakhic, but the Kabbalistic idea, the impurity of the nations. And you have many in the Kabbalah, they're very upset with these people who go to the land of Israel when they die. I already mentioned to you in the previous class what the Yerushalmi says, also, that if you don't have the strength and you don't feel the need to come and leave the Golas, leave the impurity during your lifetime, don't think you can come here in your death. I mean, this, the land of Israel is for living Jews, not for dead Jews. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda responded to Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 1950s. Lubavitcher movement. What do I mean by that? Lubavitch, out of all the Hasidic groups, is the movement that really sees no significance, not just, well, we saw Satmar. Satmar and Lubavitch basically are in agreement, and that they see no significance, not just to the state of Israel as an entity, obviously Satmar doesn't, but they see no significance really in living in the land of Israel. When you're in the land of Israel, yes, there's halachas you have to follow. Satmar and Lubavitch agree with that. You can't leave the land of Israel, there's various halachot. But there's no reason to go on aliyah. The typical Haredi, the typical Chassid, believes that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a positive thing, it's a great thing, Gemara says it's equal to so many other mitzvos, etc., etc. We already saw Satmar does not think that to be the case before the Messianic era. There's no obligation, and even there could be no real value in living in the land of Israel. Lubavitch also thought the same thing. And Lubavitch, in fact, was even worse, if you're a religious Zionist, than Satmar, because for Lubavitch, it's not just a shita, but the Satmar Rebbe had this view that since there's no temple, there's no idea of living in the land of Israel as an obligatory commandment, it's a nice thing, and there's certain mitzvahs you can do there, but it's no commandment. Lubavitch had the cult of the Rebbe, much more than any other Hasidic group, and if the Rebbe lives there, you know, there's a reason to stay there. And the Rebbe himself is responsible, because the Rebbe gave an interview, and it's not just once, I mean, this was part of the shita, in which he said as follows, and listen to Rav Tzvi Yehuda's reply. First of all, the Rebbe said that he was asked why he doesn't go to Israel. And it would have been a big deal. Remember, Hebron, for example, was a Chabad town. People come to Israel after 67. Go back to Hebron, where they were. But the Rebbe didn't send people to Israel as for Aliyah. He didn't think it was significant, other than Shluchim. And he said that Lo Mirtzocha Teitzei Min HaGalus. You'll not leave the exile on your own. And then the Rebbe said as follows, and I'll read it in Hebrew. This is from the interview he gave in Hatzofeh. Gam Shalu B'Chutz La'aretz U'B'Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo. Even when you're in Chutz La'aretz, you could be in the place where God places himself, where God chooses. The Rebbe said there's a possibility to offer karbanot mibchinat ruchanit. You can offer sacrifices in the diaspora from a spiritual sense. And then the Rebbe says, B'chol makom asher askir shmi, sham eretz Yisrael. The Rebbe said, in any place where we can, where he's portraying God saying, in every place where, you know, my name can be mentioned, that's eretz Yisrael. And this is the Chabad conception, that if you're in 770, that's your Yerushalayim. And not just the Rebbe, the Chabad Hasidim have developed this, that, you know, you're in 770, you're in Jerusalem. Not just in Jerusalem, you're in the house of the Messiah, Beit Mashiach, as many of them developed. And as you can imagine, Rav Tzvi Yehuda in this book, Lehilchot Tzibur, that I showed you last week, which is all his public proclamations, he goes to town against the Rebbe. I mean, this is, from his perspective, this is the worst thing you can possibly say. In fact, he said that the only people who would say that you can have, that the land, that the exile equals the land of Israel, are Dutton and Aviram. I mean, who else can say something like that? And he goes on and on. But it wasn't just the Rebbe, it was the Rav. The Rav, as we know, was the least Zionist of all religious Zionists. I know people who've spoken to him, and that's the same thing. He never was a great lover. In theory, he was a great lover, but in practice, he never, whenever his students went to Israel, he always wondered, what are you going to Israel for? he's a very strange type of religious Zionist, and people have spoken about it. I don't know if there's really been much written about it. Rabbi Lichtenstein, in one essay, writes about his father-in-law, how his father-in-law never quite accepted the fact that his grandchildren went to Israel. In any event, the Rav was playing off an old-time religious Zionism that I'll speak about in a few minutes, but he went even further because he didn't even go to visit there, he never encouraged Aliyah. Some people actually thought that he wasn't really a religious Zionist. He was criticized in Israel. People thought it was a fraudulent religious Zionism, that it was a literary religious Zionism, but at the end of the day, what type of Zionism is that? But the Rav was the head of Mizrahi in America, and really was the honorary head in the world. But he wrote this in On Repentance. Bondage to the state, this is page 224, bondage to the state can also become idolatry. Were all the great men of the world to ask me to sign a declaration pledging my unreserved loyalty to the state which fulfills the highest ideals of Jews today, I would by no means be willing to do so. Subjugation of this kind is tantamount to idolatry. He's speaking about how the state of Israel can also become a form of idolatry. That is, the state of Israel is valuable because of what it enables us to achieve. We can have a full Jewish life there, etc. But the state itself can become a form of idolatry. Makes sense, I think. But not for Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Again, in the Sefer, L'Hilchot Tzibor, he goes off on the Rav that, the establishment of the state of Israel is a mitzvah from the Torah, and he quotes the Vilna Gaon, that you can't say negative things about the people who live in the land of Israel, etc., etc., etc. And it's really, unlike the Lubavitch Rebbe, where he replies well to what the Rebbe says, I think his reply to the Rav is a non sequitur. He's quoting all these things that the Rav would agree with, but that misses the point of the Rav, that the state itself can become a form of idolatry. But from Tzvi Yehuda, as we saw, the army is holy. The institution of the presidency is holy. All these things have holiness. For the Rav, there's no halakhic significance to any of this. You're creating it is a form of idolatry. Tzvi Yehuda, though, was in opposition to one form of idolatry as he saw it, and that's Chassidus. And this is quite interesting. Because although Rav Tzvi Yehuda's followers made him into a Rebbe, 100%, he himself was against Chassidus. In fact, Udi Abramovitz, he's a scholar in Israel, he wrote the master's dissertation, a wonderful master's, I can send a PDF to anyone who's interested, in which he shows how Rav Tzvi Yehuda really goes back to the old Lithuanian model of Talmud study and moving away from the cult of the personality. Rav Kook, in many places of his writings, gives credence to the notion of the tzaddik. Not the tzaddik like someone's a righteous person, I mean the tzaddik, the Rebbe. In classical Hasidic literature, they didn't call it a Rebbe, they called it a tzaddik. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda speaks about how all the negative things and the problems that develop out of the cult of personality of the Rebbe, and that Torah study is the most important, and that the problem was he saw a danger in that you had these anti-Zionist Rebbes. And people would blindly follow them. If you look in Israel, when Litvisher Rabbanim didn't tell people, for example, not to go to Israel. If you asked them, they'd give you their opinion. I'm sure many of them said no. But no one felt bound by this. You didn't have this idea that you felt bound by the Litvisher Rabbanim. I mean, the Rav of your community was the Rav. He passed in Shilas. He didn't lead you every day, every minute of your day. They didn't have a notion of Das Torah like you do today. However, the Hasidus Rebbe, when he told people not to go, they didn't go. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda saw very dangerous, this cult of the personality that, how could a Rebbe tell someone not to go to live in the land of Israel? I mean, the Rebbe's more important than the mitzvah in the Torah for the Hasidic world? Yes, because the Rebbe can tell you when the mitzvah is binding, when it's not. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda was much more mitnagdic than his father. I will say, seeing that isn't fair. Did Rav Tzvi Yehuda write against Das Torah directly? Certainly. He wrote all the time against Das Torah. But which Das Torah was he writing against? He's writing against the Haredi Das Torah. This whole book, L'Hilchot Tzibor, is all Das Torah. Again, it's against Haredi Das Torah, but it's all his Das Torah. As someone asked last week, did he believe in Das Torah? He believes in Das Torah, but it's his Das Torah. And his father's Das Torah. So half these letters are letters telling you who you should vote for and things like that. So certainly he's against Das Torah, but he's against the Haredi Das Torah, which is a false Das Torah, which But he's not the only one. The Satmar Rebbe is also against Das Torah. The Satmar is all against Aguda Das Torah. It's a false thought. Everyone, well, how significant were his credentials? Well, this gets back to what we said last time. He was as significant as Rav Dessler. He's as significant as any of these Chassidish Rebbe's. That is, he's not a Shas and Poskim person, although he's a great Talmud Chacham. But he's not a Posek in that sense. He's more of a Magid. He's more of a... he's not a Posek. We're going to get to that at the very end of the class when we speak about the split in Merkaz Harag. But you don't need... In this sense, he's very much like the Hasidic world, though he didn't like the Hasidic world. In the Hasidic world, as we know, the Posek, the Talmudist, is not the most important. It's the Rebbe. Ritzi Yehuda becomes Rosh Hashiva. He's not the only Rosh Hashiva who's not. He doesn't give Shiur in Talmud. And he's not a Posek. And yet, he is like a Rebbe. He's the most important person. It's after his death that changes. But we've had this in Jewish history. You think of people, the great Musa leaders. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is not a Posek. Ritzi Yehuda follows in the model of the altar of Sabatka, of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, of Rabbi Dessler, of so many great Jewish thinkers who have influence but don't involve themselves in Pesach. But you have to remember, this, and this is the big criticism of the Haredi world. In the Haredi world, everything is Shas and Poskim. For Ritzi Yehuda, what about philosophy? What about Kabbalah? You can be an expert in those areas and be very important. The Haredi world has limited the Jewish curriculum. You have to go back to the Maharal. Why is the Maharal important? He's not important as a Posek or anything. He's important. Why is Rav Yehuda Levi? Rav Yehuda Levi, the Kuzari, is Kodesh Kadashim as well, Rav Cook said, Rav Avram Cook. These are great thinkers and great and very important. Not, they don't have to be Poskim. It's only in modern times that someone has to be a Posek or a Talmudist. So Ritzi Yehuda is moving back into a different model and a lot of expertise in Kabbalah. He doesn't write about it, usually. But certainly expertise in Kabbalah. He didn't believe it needed to be public. But I'll quote you something later today in which we see Kabbalah. He didn't believe in using it, though, publicly. But Orot is all Kabbalah. But his teachers were the Maharal and the Musar tradition and the philosophical tradition and all that. So it's a different model. So obviously they're not going to look up to someone like that the way they would look up to their leaders, although the Haredi world has had people like Rav Dessler and others as well. No, I'm not a Talmudist. The Maharal was, he was a Talmudist. He's certainly a great Talmud Chacham, but he's not known. If the Maharal never wrote his works on Kabbalah and his philosophical works, no one would have heard of the Maharal. The Alter Sabbatka was not a great Talmudist. Rabbi Dessler was a big Talmud Chacham, but he's not known because of his Talmudic learning. So you have many people who we know. The Chovos Levavos. Chovos Levavos is not only not a Talmudist, he writes in one of the famous passages against this preoccupation with strange Talmudic disputes that takes you away from Chovos Levavos. So we have models like this. They were all in favor of Das Torah, 100%. I should say all, not all religious Zionists. Ritzi Yehuda was in favor of it. And remember what we said last time, until the 67 war, Ritzi Yehuda was not a significant figure. His form of Zionism was a minority, a small minority. Chardal, which takes off in 1967, that which sees itself for Ritzi Yehuda, this whole vision of now a Chardal Das Torah, that goes back to Ritzi Yehuda. That's not part of original religious Zionism, but it's Ritzi Yehuda's religious Zionism is not Mizrahi. He felt Mizrahi was practical, it's not religious Zionism. He's a spiritual religious Zionism. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Abarbanel, Ibn Ezra. I mean, we have so many important figures whose importance is not in Talmud, it's in Radak. How can you study Tanakh without the Radak? This is Parsha Nut. Let me tell you a quick story. When I was in Boston, I used to learn at the Kollel. There's a Lakewood Kollel in Boston. And they would always ask, my chavrusa would always ask me what we do. And I never wanted to tell them because they don't understand that sort of stuff. I said to him, Moshe Idel was there for the semester and the great scholar of Kabbalah. So I told him, Moshe Idel is there, and I wanted to impress him. I said, the people in Me'asharim need to come to Moshe Idel. And I meant, of course, come to speak about Kabbalistic ideas. And I told him he's a great Kabbalistic scholar. So Macharusa said, they come to get a bracha? I mean, he had no conception. They knew so little about academic Jewish scholarship, they didn't know that they were supposed to be opposed to it. So I finally told him, after he kept bugging me, what we do, I said that we study, he said, you study maybe 5 or 10% of Jewish literature. I'm talking about kosher Jewish literature, not heretical stuff. You study Shas and Poskim. I said, we study the other 90% at the university. We study Parshanut, polemics, philosophy, mysticism. The Jewish curriculum is much broader, and Ratzvi Yehuda and the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva was about broadening the curriculum. So what is the future of Ratzvi Yehuda? No one has ever said, ever, that the Abarbanel was a Talmudist. In fact, he's a Talmudist. The Maharal, we have some tshuvah for him, and the Maharal was a Talmudist, but the Maharal's significance is not as a Talmudist. But the Abarbanel, the Ibn Ezra, Yehuda Levi, these were not Talmudists. That is, I'm not saying these were Amaratzim, but these were not people who spent their time on Talmud. Ibn Ezra writes one place how you have to do what your heart inclines you to. So we have different models. No, he was not, I don't know who you're referring to, Reb Soloveitchik, no. Reb Soloveitchik's a different example, because it depends who you ask. If you ask the people in the university, Reb Soloveitchik is great for being a philosopher, but I think it's really, anyone who says that Reb Soloveitchik has significance in his philosophy is mistaken. Yes, he is important, and that's what makes him unique, but 90% or 80% of who the Rav was the Talmudist. That's what he did day in and day out. That was his major focus. He also did philosophy, and he tried to merge some of it, but his significance in the academic world is obviously in his philosophy, but that was not his major focus. I would say the same about the Rambam, incidentally. The Rambam's significance in the academic world is his philosophy, but most of the Rambam's time and most of the Rambam's efforts was involved in halakha. And then you have people like Ibn Ezra, like Ralbag, who knew some Talmud. Ralbag might have even known more than a little. Radak, but their efforts, their major efforts, were not in Talmud. Professor Tursky wrote a number of articles focusing on this issue of what he called meta-halakha. That is, you have models in medieval and late early modern period of people, some who thought Talmud study was the most important, others who thought that Talmud study was basic, but after you finish Talmud study, you reach a certain level, you move on to philosophy, you move on to Kabbalah, and that those were the most important. The Rambam actually thought that philosophy was more important than Talmud study. But if you ask me what he spent most of his time on, he spent most of his time on Talmud. The Rav, without question, thought that Talmud study was the be-all and end-all, and philosophy was just a means of enabling you to understand traditional Talmudic Judaism better. But it wasn't an independent discipline at odds with Talmud. So what's the future of Ratzvi Yehuda's type of Judaism? I think it's certainly on the retreat. It's possible that in the end we'll see it as only an episode, although at the very end of today's class I'll tell you what we can still take from it, glean from it. I can't see that it has much life to it over the long term. I mean, we can see why it was so popular and influential, why it had so much to offer people, what it gave. I mean, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, of course, I was a follower of Tzvi Yehuda. How could you not be a follower in the early 1980s of Tzvi Yehuda? It gave people the sense that they were living in the days of redemption. It was a time when the symbols of Zionism, when the state of Israel could be almost deified, and maybe were worthy of it. It was a time in 67, for at least 20 years, or almost 20 years, when you could speak about the state as, quote, inherently holy and without blemish. And truth is, the politicians were very different. I mean, after Begin, there was a very different type of politician comes in. It became very different. Look, if you're a true believer, if you believe in the messianic determinism, every setback is simply a bump on the way to redemption. But only the true believers can hold this view, and even some of them have abandoned this. After Gush Katif, or Shmuel Tal, to give one example, a big student of Ratzvi Yehuda, he abandoned this, and he said if Ratzvi Yehuda was alive today, he'd see things are different. I think most people will see the world, see Israel, through realpolitik, not redemption. Now, the believers in the latter, the messianists, could tell their followers Yamit, and by the way, last week I said Yamit's in the south. I confused it with Sharm el-Sheikh. Of course, Yamit's in the northeast of Sinai. The messianic approach could tell their followers there would be no withdrawal from Gaza. They could prophesy. Mordechai Eliyahu actually prophesied, and I saved it because I knew they'd take it down afterwards. And one of his followers says, he quotes from Mordechai Eliyahu saying, this is a real prophecy, and that God will not make me look foolish. I mean, that's the messianic approach, but that's not the realpolitik approach. And the problem with this approach it is always proven false. In the long term, the more conventional religious Zionism of Rabbi Soloveitchik, of Rav Reines, who I hope to have classes on in the future, of Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg, that's the Zionism, the religious Zionism that I think has the staying power. It's a religious Zionism that sees the state not as inherently holy, but as a great opportunity to create a proper Jewish life. Not holy in and of itself, holy in what it creates, if it creates. And not part of the Messianic era, part of preparing us, perhaps, if we're worthy, for the Messianic drama. And as I said, some students of Ritzud have moved away from his extremist positions in this area. Rav Bin Nun, Rav Yoel Bin Nun is a big student of Rav Yehuda. And yet even he came to realize that we weren't worthy, I think he would put it that way, for Rav Yehuda's vision. That is, we just weren't worthy of it. There are some other aspects of Rav Yehuda's teachings worth mentioning. I only have 20 minutes, 25 minutes or so, and really, you know, everyone has to focus on the land of Israel, but so much else is interesting. Let me briefly say he was a strong opponent of religious separatism, the Aguda mentality. And this he followed his father's path. He even, and I'm speaking about this, I'll be God willing in Bar Ilan in 2 weeks. There's a conference on Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. It's 200 years since his birth. And I'm going to speak about views, Haredi and religious Zionist views of Hirsch. I'll speak about Ritzi Yehuda. Hirsch is a problem for Ritzi Yehuda. Why? Because Hirsch supports... The anti-Zionism is not such a problem because Hirsch is not the greatest person to be an anti-Zionist. By the way, here's another one, Samson Raphael Hirsch. He's not known for his Talmudism. He's known for his commentaries. But it's the Auschwitz that became so important, the separatism for the religious, for the Aguda types, for the Haredim. Religious separatism is vital. So Ritzi Yehuda needs to tear down Hirsch, show how the Wurzburger Rav was much more important. Bamberger, we spoke about this. I don't want to go through it again. In our talks on Hirsch, Ritzi Yehuda claims, and I don't believe it's true, but he claims that people came to Hirsch and they said, you have no right to argue with the Wurzburger Rav because he's the Gadol, not you. It was very important to Ritzi Yehuda to show that the real Gadol of Germany, the Wurzburger Rav, or Bamberger, he was against separatism. I say, I don't know if it's true, the story, it could be true, but Ritzi Yehuda would tell stories sometimes... He went before the Ark. He opens up the Ark because he said that most of the Gedolim in Europe were not against Zionism. They were on the fence. And one of the students said he didn't think that was true. Ritzi Yehuda opened the Aron Kodesh and said, on these Sifrei Torah, I tell you that it's true. But I think Ritzi Yehuda is wrong. And I mentioned before his attacks against the Hasidim. He was unfair in one of his attacks. Ritzi Yehuda said that if you look at all these great heretics, and he gave a few of them, whether the writers, he said it came because of Hasidus. That is, they were part of this cult of the personality, and when they saw that the emperor had no clothes, that is, you know, if you're in Hasidus, and you're taught that the Rebbe is, you know, the greatest thing, and yet the Rebbe could just be the Rebbe because his father's the Rebbe, and then when you see the Rebbe, who he was, that he's not so great, you could lose all faith, and in some groups they go to a different Rebbe, but others just gave up Judaism. So he criticized Hasidus, but I don't think there's any question that... If you look at people who kept their traditional Judaism, the Hasidim succeeded a lot more than the Lithuanians. The Haskalah was much more powerful in Lithuania than it was in the Hasidic world. But okay, that's the Hasidic position. Why didn't he use the position of Yitzhak Breuer? I don't know what position you're referring to. Yitzhak Breuer comes to Israel and he develops the idea of Torah's Eretz Yisrael, but he never officially really gave up his religious separatism. He moved in the direction of some sort of religious Zionism, but he still was a religious separatist. Even in Israel, you can read his writings. He's still a believer in Aguda. He just wants Aguda to change. Now, he believes cooperation with the non-religious Navy to have Torah in the state of Israel, that's not the same thing as separatism. Separatism is when you don't want to be in the same larger community. And Ritzi Yehuda thought that all Jews are a unity and that we fight together inside. But when we face the outside world, we're one, and in the land of Israel, we're building up a state, we have to do it together. So Ritzi Yehuda says, where does Auschwitz come from? And thinking back to John Hagee, it comes from Germany. Hirsch, only, and Ritzi Yehuda is right about this. In Eastern Europe, you didn't have separatism. You had it in Hungary, but that, you could say, came from Germany. You didn't have separatism in Vilna, you didn't have separatism in Poland and Lithuania. Ritzi Yehuda says because the Gedolim of Eastern Europe, and the Nitziv wrote about this, that separatism is a bad thing. The Brisker Rav, the extremist Brisker Rav, was elected by non-religious people, and in his community you had non-religious as well as religious. Tomorrow, one of the questions I'm going to ask Rav Galevsky is describe how the Brisker Rav got along together with the non-religious. And in one of the hagiographies, you can read some great stories about this, the new one by Lorenz. But in Germany, you had separatism. Rav Tzviuda says it's because the impure environment. Hirsch was infused with all of his non-Jewish ideologies, German ideologies. He loved Schiller and all this stuff. So Rav Tzviuda says it's only because Rav Hirsch was so overtaken by these anti-Torah type of ways of thinking that he was able to put forth such a non-Jewish approach as Auschwitz. Again, this is, you have to give some leeway for rhetoric here. Gedolim adopted the ideas. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda looks to it as, I mean, he says, when his criticism of Buddha, he says, look at the difference between Aguda and Mizrahi. Mizrahi was founded by a Gadol, Rav Reines. Who was Aguda founded by? Yaakov Rosenheim, a nice Baal HaBas in Germany. So how can you compare a party that's founded by a Baal HaBas who wasn't a Talmud Chacham with a party founded by Gedolim? Now, it's an unfair criticism because Rosenheim might have founded it, but Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski was certainly a Gadol B'Yisrael, and he was an Aguda. So, but you see where Rav Yehuda is getting at. I understand, but the followers of Hirsch think that the Auschwitz continues. It doesn't matter what era you're in, it continues. And Rav Yehuda thought it was puzzle from the beginning, and the proof is in the pudding, that the Gadol of Germany, the Würzburger Rav, opposed it. And incidentally, when Chaim Moser was asked about this in the 1920s even, he said, this is not a dispute that I can involve myself with. It has to be left to the Germans. But I will say that Rav Tzviuda's school has not thrown Hirsch out completely. It's not like the Haredim who throw out the religious Zionists. Yaakov Ariel was asked this very question. Yaakov Ariel is perhaps the leading postsake for the religious Zionists in Israel. I saw on Cross Currents, I went to it when he spoke about, mentioned that Rabbi Adlerstein's piece, and someone in there said that, you know, mentioned Rav Yaakov Ariel or Shai Yosef Cohen said they're more significant than the religious Zionists and Rav Yosef. And Adlerstein replied that I can't even have a conversation with someone who says this. It shows that Adlerstein doesn't know what he's talking about. The fact is that for the religious Zionist world, Rav Yosef has no significance at all. It's a completely different community. In America, the rabbis in America are connected with the Haredim, as I mentioned last class, the class before. Modern Orthodox world in America is full of Haredi rabbis. Rabbis went to Haredi yeshivas. Rabbis Haredim who teach in the schools. In Israel, it's totally separate. So the fact is that in Israel, the religious Zionist world has no interest in Rav Yosef. His psukim have no significance on that. Rav Yaakov Ariel and Rav Shai Yosef Cohen are infinitely more important than Rav Yosef. This doesn't mean they're a greater Talmud Chacham or anything in Rav Yosef, but really that's irrelevant. Because when it comes to Pesach, you don't go to the greatest Talmud Chacham. I'll grant you that Rav Yosef is greater Talmud Chacham than Rav Ariel. But he's also a greater Talmud Chacham than Rav Schechter. But I think most people in America would ask Rav Schechter because there's no rule that says you go to the Gadol Hador for every question. You go to a reliable Posek in Paskin. You don't need to ask Rav Avad Yosef every question. That's never the way Pesach has been. Rav Yaakov Ariel was asked, should we get rid of Hirsch, not study him at all? And Rav Ariel says, absolutely not. Hirsch is full of wisdom and great stuff, his Perush of Chumash, etc. One area, he said two areas actually, his anti-Zionism, his Auschwitz, that we don't accept. But we accept everything else because it's great. Now, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, though, was special in one other way. I feel I need to stress this. So people get a sense of who he is. Oh, even before I go on, just one more thing. So the extremism of Rasiuda's followers. Rasiuda has a follower named Rav Yosef Kellner. Big, you know, a follower of Rasiuda. Rasiuda has followers who are Talmidei Chachamim in the traditional sense, that is post-scheme of people and Talmudic scholars like Ner Yaguta, Rav Dov Leor, great postik of Chevron, Rav Yaakov Ariel, and many, many others, of Sonia Drori, Rav Shari Yashav Kohen is a Talmud. And then he has followers who are experts in Machshava. Many, many important people, Rav Yoel Ben-Nun and many others. So one of them is a Yosef man named Yosef Kellner. And if you think that what Hagee said is outrageous, Yosef Kellner writes that Hirsch's influence when it came to Auschwitz was so negative that the only way Mechila could be found was through Poranus HaKal, was through suffering of the community, and that's the Holocaust. This was such a... So here we have the Satmar Rebbe saying that the Holocaust comes because of Zionism and the Ritzi Yehuda and the Yema Bunim Smecha Techtots talk about because of the anti-Zionism. And here, your Rabbi Yosef Kellner, the Holocaust is punishment for Auschwitz. And by the way, it gets worse. There's rabbis, it's for the Gilgulim to be punished. Our rabbis know how to answer all these things. But let me talk about Ritzi Yehuda for a few minutes, though. Him and the simple person. We've already spoken about how you take someone like Rav Yoshev, he's totally separate from the community. And most of these Gedolim are. They have no relationship with the average person. First of all, they live surrounded by their handlers, and they only deal with Talmid Chachamim. They don't deal with the average lay person. It's not like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was with lay people. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his connection was with the common people. The simple people. Do you want to know who he loved the most? Not the Talmid Chachamim, who he loved, but everyone loves Talmid Chachamim. He loved the farmers. Because no one else loved the farmers. He loved the kibbutzniks. Someone who knew him very well told me that Ritzi Yehuda, the hugs he would give, he'd see Yom Yatzmahut, they would march together, he'd see these kibbutzniks, he'd give them hugs. He would hug the women if he could. He can't because of halacha, but he would hug everyone, the simple people. Because these people are working the land. And there's something very special about working the land. This love for every Jew, which he got from his father, obviously, I don't know any gadol the Yisrael, any great sage in modern times who's had this. Most of our gadolim are intellectuals, they can't relate to the common people, you know, they live off in a different world. The love for the common man, which Ritzi Yehuda had, that comes out in all the biographies and all the discussions, the way people speak to him. This is the way he could relate, and perhaps because he wasn't spending all his time as a Talmudist. No, Rav Avadia has the common touch, certainly. You can go on YouTube and you can see a video of him there with this Israeli rock singer. And you see that he has the common touch. Rav Avadia has always had the common touch. But it's not the same. It's not for the secularists. Rav Avadia has the common touch for the Sephardi. He doesn't have the common touch for the Ashkenazi, the rabbit eaters. And Rav Moshe, he didn't deal with these type of people. Ritzi Yehuda dealt with the secularists. Rav Moshe didn't deal with secularists. Ritzi Yehuda couldn't call anyone a Rasha. He loved everyone. He was always Malam Mitzchus, perhaps too much. But that was Ritzi Yehuda. He's also known, and his influence is very significant, in Tznius Matters. Look around. You see the girls with the long skirts down to the floor? That's not the Haredim. The Haredim refused to wear the skirts like that, precisely because that's how the Haredim wear it. Ritzi Yehuda's people wear it. The Chavetz Chaim said there's no problem showing the calf. Ritzi Yehuda said he disagrees with the Chavetz Chaim. And therefore, when he came on the scene, who was dressing like this? I mean, what was the traditional Mizrahi culture? It was Camp Masada. It was the mixed swimming. It was the Mizrahi kibbutzim. That was traditional Mizrahi culture, which still exists to a certain extent. But in the last 30 years, you have the women covering their hair, not with shadows for the most part, with the tichels. You have the skirts. In fact, not just skirts. You have the skirts down to the floor. This is all due to the influence of Ritzi Yehuda, the Chardal influence. They're the ones. In fact, I think it goes further than that. I think the whole change. I think the return to, let's say, women covering their hair. All this in the Haredi world. That it's in the modern Orthodox world. That's a result of Ritzi Yehuda, because it's only after 67 that people start going to Israel. And there's a focus, more of a focus on halakha. This is not part of the traditional Mizrahi culture. And especially in Israel, you can see they're identified. Some of them don't wear makeup. It's a very high form of tznius. Now, this eventually leads to Ritzi Yehuda's ideology. In fact, let me skip on this for a minute. If we have time, I'll come back. I want to talk about the split in Merkaz and Har HaMor. But I do want to tell you a few things that I did say from the secret work. And not all of it is secret, because some of this stuff was reprinted in other writings, but some of it is. So let me just give you a sense of some of the interesting things he says. I was asked before about Hesder. So I don't need to repeat that, how Hesder is not the equivalent of full-time Torah study. And that's the sort of thing also. You don't want to insult the Hesder people, so I could see why they don't want this spread around. But that was his idea. He was asked, what is it about Merkaz that they bring in things like nationalism? Remember Rav Shach's big criticism of the religious Zionists, that it's a shotness, it's kilayim, they bring in nationalism. And Ritzi Yehuda replies, nationalism, this isn't separate. This is basic to Torah. In fact, from Ritzi Yehuda's perspective, you're not a complete Jew if you're not a nationalist. He was asked why in Merkaz they spend so much time learning emunah. That's what they call it. And he develops the idea that, like I said before, how important this is, and that the Jewish curriculum needs to be expanded. And then he's asked, this is the question, why is it that the yeshiva students in Merkaz don't dress like yeshiva students? That is, they don't wear black hats, and they don't wear jackets, and all that. And he replies that there's no halachas about wearing dress. We dress in a halachically proper fashion. And look, this is developed often by him and his followers that, I mean, the whole black, dressing black, they can tell you all the reasons why it's a mistake anyway. You're not supposed to separate yourself from the community. The Gemara says that you wear black if you want to do a sin, etc., etc. But a famous story is of Shari Yashav Cohen, who was an army chaplain, who's, by the way, his sister, Rav Gorin's wife, the daughter of the Nazir, passed away this week. When he got married, he wore his army uniform. And people criticized him. They said, this isn't the way for a Rav to dress. You know, because he was a big Talmud Chacham, and he was a Rav. He married, incidentally, he married the daughter of the rabbi of the West Side Institutional Synagogue, whose name escapes me now. The son-in-law of Fischel, Goldstein, Herbert Goldstein. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda said to Rav Shari Yashav, you wear your army uniform. The army uniform is the sign of the holy, IDF, the symbol of the reconstituted Jewish state. The garb, the jacket and the hat, that's from Goyesha Europe. That's not a Jewish outfit. And that's also an important point, because when you wear the dress, the European dress, the stains, the impurities of the Golis to the land of Israel. And that is true. Iris, you asked a good question. Rav Kook was particular about dress. He has a letter, actually. He's opposed to the Chevron Bachrim. The Chevron Bachrim came in with their fancy dress, and they were shaved, and he didn't like that. However, I think it's different. I think that there was a traditional dress of yeshivas in those days. I think it wasn't black in those days. It was that they wore beards. I think the beards is really, it's not the clothes so much. These people were so poor they didn't have much clothes. It was the beards that he was very opposed to. But also, he didn't believe it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, though, feels that you dress in in those days, everyone dressed with jackets and ties and hats. That was the dress code. He says in the state of Israel today, that's not the dress code. So for him, it wasn't important. He's not against it, per se. Although among his followers, you'll find people against it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda himself dressed that way. He's a Rav. But it has no importance. It has no chashivas. And when it becomes a thing of importance, you're taking away. Short coats, yes, that's right. Short coats also, which was the standard. He thought that was breaking with the dress of in Jerusalem. But I don't know if he had a problem with it when they moved to Hebron so much. He didn't want it in Jerusalem. But that was a dress. You're right, Rav Kook thought that this was yeshivish dress. But what can I say? By the way, even after Rav Kook died, if you look at pictures of America's guys from the 30s, from the 40s, they're all wearing the long coats, the long yeshivish coats. You know, if you came in, Rav Tzvi Yehuda would say, don't wear it. The point is, it has no chashivas. It has no halachic significance. It's not important from his standpoint. So if you want to say he differs from his father, maybe. Okay. Now, why doesn't the yeshiva... he's asked, why can't the state return land? After all, the state, can't they make the decision? It's their land. And he develops the idea that the land doesn't belong to the state. It belongs to Jews all over. And he has a letter in this book, description of a letter. One of the Ramakals, one of the chief of the head of the commands in Israel in the 1970s, spoke about how we can't return any land for security reasons. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda wrote him a letter rebuking him. It has nothing to do with security. It has to do with this is our land. So, in fact, his language was, this is the land of our fathers. So one of the students asks, well, what's the problem? He's not religious. If he wants to defend the Eretz Yisrael Shleima, complete land of Israel, for security reasons, it's a good thing. Let him do it. Well, what's the problem? Why should we object to that? That's his argument. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda replies that we must speak to the nation with godless. We must always try to raise the people. That is, it's good that he wants to hold on to all the land, but the reason has to be right as well. I don't have time to go into his views of various non-religious personalities, but let me point out one more point. Here's his commentary to Orot, which came out last year. And just so you think, he's very different than Meir Kahana. yes, he's a strong nationalist. He believes in holding the land. But listen to this language. He's an ethnocentrist, which leads to great love of everyone. Because there's a concern, obviously. There's a problem that if you love Jews and if you put the focus on how special Jews are, what about the non-Jews? And this is with Tzvi Yehuda writing. If you want to get close to greatness and knowledge and understanding and holiness, this is my suggestion. Love non-Jews. And the Torah says, which means to love Jews. But from the higher holiness, Yesh hadracha l'hav gam goyim. We're also supposed to love everyone. Hamach shalano enenu shovanisti. Shalino shalacherim. And he goes on that it's not about chauvinism. We want to love everyone. We want to help everyone. Obviously, our major focus is for the Jewish community. But this love of Jews will then lead to the next step of love of everyone. There's a focus in Rav Tzvi Yehuda, the extreme nationalist. He spoke out against negative portrayals of Arabs. I mean, very different than Kahana, and very different than some of his followers today. You get together with, and you have this in Rav Avraham Cook, together with the great nationalism about having the specialness of the Jew, a love of all people, a desire to be connected to all people, and to see the good in all people. He calls Tolstoy Shlita. Some of you have heard my lecture on this. So a very special personality, and I think, people like Yoel Ben-Nun say that his followers in Chevron and Beit El, they only take one aspect. They only take the particularistic, just like they accused him of only taking the particularistic, that is Rav Tzvi Yehuda. So there's so much there. And so what can we take from Rav Tzvi Yehuda, though, if we don't share his politics? The love for all Jews. The desire for help of everyone. I mean, we're living in an era where you speak about, you quote a verse from Isaiah, a social justice type verse, and people think you're a Reform rabbi or something, or a Chovei Torah graduate. I mean, they think that's how it's twisted. And not just the religious Zionism, right? When religious Zionism, the Haredi world, is just totally insular. And that's not the Torah way, at least according to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Obviously, others have a different perspective. The need for all Jews to be a unity. That's obviously, I think, very important for all of us to take from him. The rejection of the Haredi notion that the Torah world lives apart in some other dimension, that it need not concern itself with wider society. Rav Tzvi Yehuda taught us that we must think about the nation and the country as a whole, since everyone is taking part in this great endeavor. Tzohar, this organization, which now is interested in everything, religious perspectives on the environment, on social justice, on making sure that workers are treated properly. These are followers of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who decided that it's time to adopt the vision, not just to focus on the land, but bring this vision to the wider sphere. I mean, the fact that it's only people in the religious Zionist communities that can write Torah articles like religious perspectives on, the environment and workers' compensation, things like that, that's a problem. But and Tzohar is taking the best of Rav Tzvi Yehuda and bringing it out. The non-religious, of course, need to do tshuva. Rav Tzvi Yehuda constantly spoke about how the non-religious need to do tshuva. But he said the Haredim need to do tshuva as well. The Haredim need to recognize that God has given us a land, God's providence is watching over it, and if the Haredim do tshuva, and the non-religious do tshuva, it'll be a much better place, a lot of happiness. It's a philosophy of optimism, without question. It's a philosophy that we can make the world a better place. It's in opposition to the Chazon Ish and Rav Shach's quietism, that we wait in our corner, God runs the show, we just do Torah and Mitzvot, so we don't get involved in these larger things. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says that that's the way you live in the Golus. The world for Rav Tzvi Yehuda is not full of evil, and we don't need to keep away from it. There are aspects, of course, we need to keep away from, but as long as we're living in the land of Israel, see, that's the problem. When you're living in the diaspora, you can't control the impurity that comes into you. When you're in the land of Israel, you're protected by the holiness, you have a proper hashkafa outlook, and then from your own house, you can venture out and take the best. Rav Tzvi Yehuda believed in taking the best of the outside world. He read secular literature. He thought there was value there, not for everyone, but for those students who are prepared, and certainly technologically, etc. Everything has a potential for holiness. Very 1960s. He dies in 1982. And really, with this, I think we've completed Rav Tzvi Yehuda. I think you get a very good sense. The yeshiva did split. It split before the followers of Tzvi Tao and Avraham Shapiro. Avraham Shapiro really wanted to bring the yeshiva back to a focus on, that is, the Rosh Yeshiva as a Talmudist. He wasn't, Avraham Shapiro never had this ideological attachment to the state as holy in and of itself, which is why he could tell his followers to, civil disobedience, not listen to the army. Rav Tao, really, he's not a posek, he's not a Talmudist, he's a follower of Rav Yehuda, he's a machshava person, a philosophical person. And he still holds to the old ideology of Yehuda, that the state itself is holy. So there were real distinctions. I was in Merkaz in 92 or 93, and I remember the yeshiva hadn't yet split then. And the person I was staying with, he's the one who gave me this document, the secret book, was telling me about all the machokas, all the conflict, which I knew nothing about because it was on the inside. But 2 years later, it really breaks. And the Haramor Yeshiva is a great yeshiva, 400 or 500 students. Merkaz is a great yeshiva, a great Talmid Chachamim coming out of it. It is true to say, though, they don't have the influence they used to. I think for Merkaz to retrieve its influence, resume its influence, is once again to return to the idea of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Cook. Not everything has to be focused on the land. They have so much more they can offer. If they just focus on the land and that becomes the be-all and end-all, then they become irrelevant to many people. If they move in the direction of Tzohar, Rav Yoel ben Nun and Rav Yaakov Arieu and many others, and go back to the old vision where land is important, they're not giving up on that, of course, but there's so much more, then they can once again be a religious Zionism that can influence the state as a whole. Now, before we get into the questions, we have a few questions. Let me just quickly tell you about some of the interesting things, because one of you asked me about this, so I just want to say it. By the way, one of you asked me how I know what the population in Israel. There's something called the Gutman Center in Israel, and they claim if you add Mesoratim to Datiim. Now, what are Mesoratim? It's hard to know. I mean, those are Sardim who, I don't know if it means they're not public Sabbath filers. I'm not sure exactly what a Mesorati is. It becomes 3.5 times larger than the Haredim, which is incredible when you think about it, because the Haredim are running the rabbinate now. And I said that my understanding is that the religious Zionists are double than the Haredim. You can look at the election results. National Religious Party, which is bigger than all these others, not to mention all the other parties. So that's the statistics from the Gutman Center. Someone asked me about the Chafetz Chaim. Did the Chafetz Chaim have non-religious relatives? I don't know. People have an interest in this, grandchildren. Now, I actually think it's important to mention this briefly, because today you have so many people becoming non-religious. You always had, but the Haredi world recognizes it. They talk about this phenomenon off the derech. I think it's important to recognize there's nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, the greatest scholars and Talmidei Chachamim and sages had children and grandchildren who weren't religious. So I think it's important that people can recognize it happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person did anything wrong. But since you asked about the Chafetz Chaim, the Pupko family is the Chafetz Chaim's family. There's a Veronica Pupko, she's a professor, she's a great-granddaughter of the Chafetz Chaim in Boston. And she's not religious, she's involved in all sorts of things, but the famous one is Jean-Pierre Pupko. Jean-Pierre Pupko, the great-grandson of the Chafetz Chaim, was the Minister of Culture in Belgium. And he's involved in all sorts of Francophone type of activities. He's as far removed from Judaism as anyone can imagine. I'll just mention another one. We spoke with Shimon Shkupa a few weeks ago. I'm going to be going to Bar Ilan, God willing, in 2 weeks. And if I have a chance, I want to see an interesting archive there. There's an archive there, letters of Shimon Shkupa to his granddaughter. His granddaughter is Fega Ilanit. Does anyone know who Fega Ilanit was? Fega Ilanit was a member of the first Knesset for the Mapam Party, the Communist Party. Did Rav Shimon disown his granddaughter? Of course not. He has beautiful letters to her. But you know who Fega Ilanit's grandson was? And anyone could be proud of her son, even if Rav Shimon Shkupa had a problem with his granddaughter. Does the name Uri Ilan mean anything to anyone? Uri Ilan captured in the Golan Heights, if I'm not mistaken, or in Syrian territory in the 1950s. He had entered Syrian territory with a group of others. Rather than being tortured to give up Israeli secrets or anything, he commits suicide. He was a member of the Golani Infantry Brigade, and his most famous, he wrote a scrap of paper, which was later returned to to his family when the Syrians, there was some trade. He wrote, Lo bagati, I did not betray. And, I mean, he's, that's the son of Fega Ilanit, was Uri Ilan. So, and that's Rav Shimon Shkop's family. Like I said, I think Rav Shimon Shkop, although he obviously wasn't religious or anything, Rav Shimon Shkop could be very proud of what became of his great-grandson. I found, incidentally, this good Wikipedia, both Hebrew and English, of Uri Ilan and Fegi Ilanit. So with this, we come to the end. I believe this is the 40th or the 41st. His son was a Maskir. Well, Shimon had more than one son. He had a few. But when you say he's a Maskir, I don't know if he was a Shomer Shabbos or not. I mean, plenty of Maskirim were Shomer Shabbos. So this is not from the son in Toronto, though. So if anyone has any questions or comments, if not, I'm sure there will be some. We always do. But this is a pleasure, as always. We had to end it short because I'll be away for 2 more weeks, and I couldn't really do it in Israel unless I was going to go to David's house in Beit Shemesh. But it's a little early for me to do it. I hope this is worthwhile. His views were as problematic, I think. It's a good question, where his views is problematic. On the one hand, the Lubavitch Rebbe's views were much more problematic because the Lubavitch Rebbe was a false messiah, and the Lubavitch Rebbe, from Rashach's perspective, was literally creating a false religion. On the other hand, this is just Chabad, really. It didn't really have any influence in Israel. Chabad's not powerful in Israel. So his concern was about the future, what this could lead to, that this could be accepted. However, with the Ratzvi Yehuda, you're dealing with the reality. The religious Zionists are running the state of Israel, and they're spreading a false hashkafa. So in his when you look at his backyard, the most immediate threat was religious Zionism. You have to count up in his letters. I think they're probably evenly divided. The difference is that his letters against religious Zionism span since he started writing letters. The letters against Chabad only begin in the 1970s. So I don't know. I think he thought both were terrible threats. It's hard to say. Yes. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, I mentioned that in the Great Dispute, Rav Henkin was the only great poseg who defended Rav Gorin. Rav Tzvi Yehuda was the other great Rav who defended him. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he was the defender of Rav Gorin. Now, the Haredim said that when someone lives as a Jew, remember, there's no evidence that this Langer guy was ever converted, but he lived as a Jew, and the Haredim said if you live as a Jew, then we can't take away your Judaism. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda made the case that, like Rav Gorin did, that there was no proof he was ever Jewish. It's so ironic, because today, not only are the Haredim go against everything they used to say, they are saying that even if there was a Beis Din, it's not valid. Maybe there's a distinction, because they know this Beis Din, they think this Beis Din is full of evil people. I don't know, but it's very strange, because the Haredi perspective today is that if someone does not live religiously, that's the proof the conversion was never valid. The Haredi perspective then, Langer went to church. But they said, the fact is, the Gemara is explicit. If you're Oved Avodah Zarah, it doesn't matter. If the conversion is valid, it's you're Jewish. Even though there was no evidence that Langer ever lived even 1 minute as a religious Jew, he didn't even know Shema, the Haredim said, it doesn't matter. We can't start uprooting people's Judaism. So it's ironic how times have changed. If you look at some of the Haredi blogs about this, that is, people in the Haredi world who are very cynical, they're writing about this. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda was the big defender of Gorin. Not only that, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was very opposed to him being voted out, etc. Okay, anything else? Thank you, Noah, from Melbourne. If those who haven't heard the previous talk, sometimes I say things which really allude to the previous one. They're all available. I think for $30 you can get the whole set of them. I don't get any money, but it all goes to Torah in Motion. I think that for those who haven't heard, who want to continue along with us, we really have been building a great deal since we've started, so it would be helpful. But again, I thank you all for comments, for questions, for keeping me on my toes, for correction, especially thank you, Ares, for always keeping me on my toes, for correcting me if I don't say it 100%, but it's important. You have to be very meddakdek with your lashon, that everything has to be 100% correct. It's harder when you speak because you don't. It's not when you're writing. When you write, they say you have to sit Shiva Nakim. You have to sit 7 clean days. But when you speak, sometimes it just comes out. In any event, thank you all. Chaim Hershenson, God willing, is coming. Rav Reines is coming. Rav Yosef Kalischer is coming. The Nazir is coming. There's many more to come.
Mark, I just want again now orally. I hope my camera's my voice is working because I know my camera's not working.
Voice
but anyways,
is working.
I just want to thank you on behalf of everybody and Yasher Koach. And I will reiterate, you're correct. You can listen to all the past tapes, and really, we've enjoyed it very much. I have personally enjoyed it very much, and thank you very much. And of course, we look forward to learning with you both online and of course live in Toronto also. And Yeshkoch, have a great trip in Israel. You'll do a little bit of scouting on our behalf, of course, and we'll speak to you soon.
Okay, good night.